morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I start today's program with a sorrowful sayonara to two remarkable friends, Bill and Sally Stidell, who have recently died 2 days apart in Cannon Beach, which they both helped make famous with their art. Both together and individually were vital members of the solid core of Cannon Beach's noted artistry. Just as they shared their lives and art, so too their obituary in the Astorian newspaper, which I quote, "William and Sarah Stidell have passed away. Bill on October 18th, Sally on October 21st. The celebration of their lives together will be held December 28th at the Coaster Theater, with the doors opening at 1 p.m. for cider and hugs and music at 2 p.m. Formal speaking will begin at 2:30 p.m. to go until finished and no earlier. William Bill Stidell was born in Goshen, New York on July 24th, 1928, to Robert F. and Edna Stidell. Bill graduated from Pratt Institute of Industrial Arts and attended Columbia University, the University of Oregon, and the University of Arizona. He worked briefly at Disney and Simon & Schuster. That's Walt Disney, if anyone doesn't know the name, whose birthday is this month. He's also deceased. Bill served in the U.S. Coast Guard from 1952 to 1956 out of Astoria on the buoy tender Mallow and the cutter Bonham. Bill has had a gallery in Cannon Beach since the 1960s, and his son Sam expects to keep the gallery open and offer Bill's art for years to come, with old and new never-seen images from the archives. Sarah Sally Keeley was born in Haynesville, Louisiana, on October 15, 1930. She spent her youth in Magnolia, Arkansas, where her mother's family operated a hotel and her mother had a millinery and clothing store. Eventually, they moved to Clackamas, where her father worked in the World War II wartime shipyards. She went to college at both Oregon State University and the University of Oregon to study medical illustration and teaching. During her summers off, she held jobs at a clothing and wedding dress store in Portland as a model, or in Stechin, serving the Golden West Lodge. Sally was a teacher at the Broadway Middle School, and then in Astoria as a student teacher coordinator. She developed a business in Cannon Beach at Sandpiper Square in 1979, which continued into the 1990s. Together, the couple, Bill and Sally, have had 5 galleries in Cannon Beach that helped the community design for the future and helped create a theater and establish Cannon Beach as the Oregon community for the arts. Bill and Sally are survived by their son, Sam Stidell, daughter-in-law, Deborah Laws Stidell, and granddog, Sparky. And to continue in the sense of Cannon Beach as an art colony, of which Bill and Sally were extremely prominent, I'm going to read The Best Thing, a book which chronicles Cannon Beach's early artistic era. It's an article by Nancy McCarthy. With its fabled scenery, Cannon Beach has always attracted artists. But when hippies began showing up with canvases, crafts, and cameras in the 1960s, residents worried they would ruin the town. In the late 60s, early 70s, it was a time of cultural clash. Cannon Beach at the time was very conservative, said Reinmar Bartle, whose book, The Best Thing That Ever Happened to Cannon Beach, chronicles the era between 1960 in 1985 when Cannon Beach was a true artist's colony. The city fathers in those days were freaked out by all of these young hippies coming to town, Reinmar said. Despite residents' fears, however, the arts focus became what then-Mayor Gerald Gower called the most wonderful thing that ever happened to Cannon Beach. Bartle, a retired city planner who moved to Cannon Beach in the 1970s and observed the village's evolution as a close-knit artistic community, tried to capture that history before it was too late. It was a special time in Cannon Beach. I thought there should be a record of it, Bartle said. Some of our friends started getting sick and dying, and I thought, now's the time. The book consists of short biographies and photos of 111 artists who spent time in Cannon Beach. It also describes 61 galleries and studios, ranging from a gas station annex to the White Bird Gallery, which celebrated its 50th anniversary just recently. Colored plates of some artists' works are included as well. In addition to interviewing artists, Bartle perused 25 years of local newspapers, including the Cannon Beach Gazette and Seaside Signal. Bartle included stories about artists and their exhibits in the book. The reasons artists descended on the town are as diverse as the artists themselves. Painter and sculptor Jane Horns, a Portland Museum Art School student, visited the area on a field trip in 1964. Horns was stranded when the school bus left without her, so she found a $25 room in Cannon Beach. She spent the summer exhibiting her work in the M&M building, home to numerous art galleries through the years. The building now houses the Sesame and Lilies store. Painter Steve McLeod rode his motorcycle to Cannon Beach during a cross-country tour in 1970 and became one of Cannon Beach's beloved residents until his death in 2015. Frank LaCaff visited his family's cabin in 1960 and eventually opened the Sketchpad Gallery at a gas station. He later renovated a building on Hemlock Street into a home and gallery and sold that to artists Harry and Hannah Griever, who still operate the gallery. Jim Hanen decided to open a stained glass studio in 1975 in Cannon Beach after a visit. In those days, an artist could rent a place large enough to live and work in for $50 a month. I thought what a cool thing it would be to live in Cannon Beach and have a shop in Cannon Beach, said Hanen, who still lives in the area and sells his glasswork. It was such a different town. There was something kind of dreamy about it. Bartle also tells the story of Joe Police, a metal sculptor who became Cannon Beach's mayor. Police was commissioned to do a sculpture, a Sacagawea, at the then new Breakers Point condominium development. Police died in 1980 before he started the sculpture. His wife, Pat Egan Police, completed it with the community's help. There was a lot of creative energy, Bartle said. There were a lot of reasonably young people starting out their lives and careers, and they had ideas. They were different from the 1950s, early 60s mainstream ideas, and it created something. It wasn't just in the arts. There was a revolution in what kind of town we should be and how we get there. When Portland State University opened the Haystack Summer Arts Program in 1969, Cannon Beach became an even greater draw for artists and visitors from throughout the United States. The program, which continued for more than 30 years, impacted the village economically and culturally. But those early days were special, Bartle said, because the arts were woven into the community. That was the best time in Cannon Beach. There's no doubt about it. I think it was a special time. I really do, he said. And now, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, by Zeynep Tufekci. A bird flu pandemic would be one of the most foreseeable catastrophes in history. And she wrote this for the New York Times. Almost 5 years after COVID blew into our lives, the main thing standing between us and the next global pandemic is luck. And with the advent of flu season, that luck may well be running out. The H5N1 avian flu, having mutated its way across species, is raging out of control among the nation's cattle, infecting roughly a third of the dairy herds in California alone. Farm workers have so far avoided tragedy, as the virus has not yet acquired the genetic tools to spread among humans. But seasonal flu will vastly increase the chances of that outcome. As the colder weather drives us all indoors to our poorly ventilated houses and workplaces, we will be undertaking an extraordinary gamble that the nation is in no way prepared for. All that would be more than bad enough, but we face these threats gravely hobbled by the Biden administration's failure, one might even say refusal, to respond adequately to this disease or to prepare us for viral outbreaks that may follow. And the United States just registered its first known case of an exceptionally severe strain of Mpox. As bad as the Biden administration has been on pandemic prevention, of course, it's about to be replaced by something far worse. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Donald Trump's pick to lead the nation's vast public health agency, has already stated he would not prioritize research or vaccine distribution were we to face another pandemic. Kennedy may even be hastening its arrival through his advocacy for raw milk, which can carry high levels of the H5N1 virus and is considered a possible vector for its transmission. We might be fine. Viruses don't always manage to adapt to new species, despite all the opportunities. But if there is a bird flu pandemic soon, it will be among the most foreseeable catastrophes in history. Devastating influenza pandemics arise throughout the ages because the virus is always looking for a way in, shape-shifting to jump among species in ever-novel forms. Flu viruses have a special trick. If two different types infect the same host, a farm worker with regular flu who also gets H5N1 from a cow, they can swap whole segments of their RNA, potentially creating an entirely new and deadly virus that has the ability to spread among humans. It is likely that the 1918 influenza pandemic, for example, started as a flu virus of avian origin that passed through a pig in eastern Kansas. From there, it likely infected its first human victim before circling the globe on a deadly journey that killed more people than World War I. And that's why it's such a tragedy that the Biden administration did not, or could not, do everything necessary to snuff out the U.S. dairy cattle infection when the outbreak was smaller and easier to address. Last winter, when cattle in the Texas panhandle started getting sick, it wasn't the established public health channels that figured it out. It took the efforts of a single veterinarian, Dr. Barb Peterson, who had the foresight and the determination to get some examples and send them to a friend at Iowa State University who could test for bird flu. The results, and what has since come into view about the speed of the spread, should have set off every alarm imaginable. Even now, however, there is little routine testing of farm workers or close contact tracing for those who fall ill. We still have way too little information on how the virus spreads among cows. Its genetic sequences are being published very late, if at all, and without the kind of data necessary to understand and trace the outbreak. And the way the virus is spreading from herd to herd makes it clear that infected cows are still being moved around rather than isolated. One recent study of 115 farm workers found that about 7% of them showed signs of recent undetected H5N1 infection. They have been going about their lives, visiting markets, churches, other homes, while harboring the potential seed of a new pandemic. Last year, when a milder strain of Mpox first reached the United States, we saw a glimpse of what an effective public health response looks like. The White House appointed Robert Denton, an experienced FEMA administrator, and Dimitri Dasikalakis, a high-ranking official from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, to head the response. Dasikalakis has extensive experience combating sexually transmitted diseases that disproportionately affect the gay community. While some right-wing critics obsessed over his tattoos, the pair led a smart campaign to vaccinate and educate, effectively ending the outbreak. For the H5N1 outbreak among dairy cattle, however, the CDC has limited powers. This show is run by the United States Department of Agriculture, led under Biden by Tom Vilsack, an alumnus of the Obama administration, who in between those two postings took a turn in a powerful dairy industry position. The agency had already been weakened by attacks on its scientific side during the first Trump term. This time around, at a critical juncture, it has put a higher value on the short-term profits of the powerful dairy farming industry than on the health of billions of people. Meanwhile, worrying signs keep cropping up. Just a few weeks ago, a pig in a backyard farm in Oregon was found to have bird flu. It seems to have gotten it from sick poultry on the same farm. Pigs cause extra worry because they are considered to be ideal mixing vessels for various animal flu viruses to adapt and spread among humans. Last week, the virus was found in a flock of ducks at a pet fair in Hawaii, the one state that had not previously found a case, probably transmitted by wild birds, which continued to spread the illness far and wide. Of the 34 individuals who were exposed at that pet fair, including 13 who had respiratory symptoms, all were offered voluntary testing. 5 declined. A teenager in Canada was infected, and the virus shows some key mutations that bring it closer to adapting to spread among humans. This outbreak has so far been mostly mild in humans, but historically it has been deadly, and further mutations could make it so again. That Canadian is in critical condition, unable to breathe independently. There is also an infected child in California who is not known to have come into contact with any sick animals at all, which raises the terrifying possibility that he got it from another human being. And the virus levels in the wastewater in several states keep spiking. It is certainly true that taking on powerful industrial farming interests would have created political headaches for the Biden administration. Perhaps it is even true that if it had done the right thing and acted aggressively to stomp out the cattle outbreak, it could have cost the Democrats the presidency, the House, and the Senate. Well, never mind. I can only hope we continue to get lucky. We don't have much else going for us. We do have one thing. Biden is president for another 7 weeks or so. It's not too late for him to give the nation a parting gift. He could start taking these risks as seriously as he should have when the cattle infections were discovered. we could get serious about mandatory testing of cows, milk, and farm workers, and about isolating infected cattle herds, as we already do for birds and pigs. We could speed up development of a vaccine that's already in the works for cows and expedite all precautions for humans also. It is true that one doesn't get proper, timely credit for disasters averted, but history will eventually deliver its verdict. And that was by Kenneth Tufekci, who is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University and the author of Twitter and Tear Gas, The Power and Fragility of Networked Protest. And he is a New York Times opinion columnist. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is this program's engineer. As we once more apprehend a second term as President of the USA by Donald Trump, whose first term has been considered the most vile in U.S. history, and whose reelection is a sordid stain on democracy, it might once more be vitally appropriate to evaluate his use of the word vermin during his first term. He used the V word in a speech on Veterans Day 2023. Trump emphatically declared that if reelected, he would root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and the radical leftist thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country, quote unquote. To be taken in context, in his first term as president, Trump declared that he, and only he, should be the decider of American citizenship rather than the constitutional birthright it has been since the birth of the Republic. From the start of his sordid, retrogressive presidency, Trump aggressively attempted to dismantle democracy and reimpose the twin evils of male supremacy and homestyle fascism. We might find historical precedents by researching similar megalomaniacal demons, the twin Roman monsters, Caligula and Nero, come readily to mind. Trump's calling human beings vermin should be a dire warning of his renewed opportunity to abolish constitutional government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And I presume that much of Trump's vote was from those ill-disposed for a woman to be president, and that they will soon suffer the thorns of their sexist affliction.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.